You're listening to The Osiris Munir Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, all my luminaries, my looms out there. That's what I love to call you. How's your week been, kids? It's been, I tell you, our planet is going through so many changes and shifts and bumps and grinds that from one day to the other, we question ourselves to really say, is this our reality or is it some aspect of a sci-fi movie we're experiencing? It's so bizarre these days. First of all, let's get a shout out to our sponsor. Yay, Kevin Pike, Senior Real Estate and Probate Specialist here at Coldwell Banker, 818-571-1508. If you'd like to talk to him about anything, he is there to talk about anything you want to do, whether it's personal, private, as long as it has to do with housing, getting you someplace to make you happy, leaving someplace you no longer want or have outgrown, call Kevin. 818-571-1508. Okay, now, you know, our next guest let me just lead in by saying in the 1990s, there was a lot of things going on music-wise while everybody else was bebopping and hip-hopping and doing all the things to do with hip-hop. And I think it was heavy metal was out. It was a few genres that were top of the line. And while everybody else was doing those things, our guest today had to witness a high-powered celebrity event. He is, and at that time, we'll talk to him more about what he's doing now. He was the general manager and owner of Mezzaluna, the restaurant in Brentwood. Now, I don't know if he was the owner, but I know he was the general manager. So he got to meet a lot of people, is what I'm leading up to. His people that came into the restaurant in Brentwood, they're high powered. They're celebrities, friends of celebrities, people that want to know celebrities that would spend that kind of money to go into the restaurant. Our guest today is the author of a very powerful book. When I saw the title and the tagline, Stalked is the name of the book. He's an author, writer. When I saw the tagline, it could have been me, my heart bled and went out to him. I mean, we've all experienced levels of betrayal, but when you have to witness someone being murdered and cut down right before your very eyes, and then going, especially someone you love very deeply, it can be a rough ride. So I would like to welcome our guest today. His story has been a keynote in the trial of the century in the 90s. You might remember it. It was the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend Ron Coleman. And this gentleman, our guest today, Keith Slomczewicz, was there to witness the whole thing. As a matter of fact, he was the boyfriend at the time. Were you dating Nicole at the time, Keith, when this all happened? So we're going to get the story straight from him. And before we talk to him, my heart goes out to you, dear heart, that you were brave enough to come almost 30 years later and tell us your story. So I want to start off by asking you, when you were with the Mezzaluna at the time, you were on stage a lot. You had to be a good manager, be a good facilitator of people's moods, personalities, their various traits, and things like that. What was one of the things in the culture that came into the restaurant that you witnessed that the public would have missed?
Well, my restaurants were very celebrity driven. I opened Mezzaluna in Aspen first in 1986.
See?
And branched out from Aspen to Beverly Hills for the second Mezzaluna, and then Mezzaluna Brentwood, which most people are familiar with because of Ron Goldman's employment there, and Nick had her last meal there, obviously. And then I opened the Monkey Bar, Los Angeles. And anyone who was around in the 90s in LA knew of the Monkey Bar. It was A-list celebrity craziness. from open to close every night. Jack Nicholson and Don Henley were two of our celebrity partners, along with another gentleman, Alan Finkelstein, who was the brainchild. But my company, Mezzaluna Restaurants Incorporated, I was general manager slash director of operations. So I oversaw operations at all the restaurants. I traveled back and forth from Aspen to Los Angeles. And that's how I met Nicole in Aspen, first off. And then our relationship sort of blossomed while in Los Angeles for work.
Oh, so you met in Aspen, not in Brentwood in LA at the restaurant. So she was, how did she, was she a waiter in the same restaurant, or how did you guys enter, how did you meet her initially? She came in and just had dinner, or what happened?
She was skiing in Aspen, Colorado one day. Mm-hmm. In 1992, she had just separated from OJ, and she had come to Aspen, in her words, to get away from her abusive husband. She didn't tell me who he was. I didn't really care at the time. I just know I saw what I thought was the most beautiful woman I had ever seen across the ski deck. And I made up my mind I was going to walk right up to her and talk to her. So I did. And we started with small talk. We chatted a little more. I invited her in for dinner that night. We could tell that we were sort of clicking a little bit. She asked me if I wanted to go out afterwards. And we did. So we spent one fantastic evening together. I chronicle it start to finish in the book. And that's how we met initially. She was leaving to head back to Los Angeles the next morning. So we only had that one night together. But we said to each other, Mezzaluna just happened to be her favorite restaurants. And she lived right down the street from the one in Brentwood. So when she found that out, I would be in LA in a couple of months for business. We agreed that we would see each other as soon as I got there. And we'd sort of pick up where this one great night we had together left off. And that's how it happened.
Wow, that's, I number one, I love stories about how people meet and fall in love. I think they're interesting. The circumstances that surround them. So after the trial, and after all was said and done, you had to return, not to your regular life, but to a life that you had to then try to find a way to put back together, I'm imagining. Did you feel that you were treated differently or viewed differently by people that came into the restaurant after that? Were you stared down, bamboozled, or anybody tried to mess with you in any kind of negative way?
Well, so much transpired in between the murders and the end of it. I had left the Mezzaluna restaurant group several months before the murders. So I was in Atlanta getting ready to scout out locations for my own restaurant the night that Nicole was murdered. We had not been together for some period of time. She was trying the reconciliation with OJ, which obviously failed miserably and led to her death. But I found out, and the family asked me if I would please come back to LA, be a part of the funeral, a pallbearer for Nicole, which I did. And that led into testifying for the grand jury and then being put under subpoena to testify in the main trial for both the prosecution and the defense. So to answer your question, so much transpired. I was under lock and key for a year, year and a half, waiting to testify, couldn't work, couldn't really live a normal life. The media knew who I was. They knew my story from my grand jury testimony. So I was followed. I was tracked down. I had to sneak around in the trunks of cars if I wanted any privacy to go to a restaurant. I was offered $1 million in cash for my story. I was offered book deals. I was offered all kinds of things, turned it all down to do the right thing. And after the verdict, when I had gone to New York to kind of disappear into the crowd there while I was waiting to testify, to answer your question, yes, I was treated differently. People recognized me, knew who I was, and wanted to know the inside story, wanted to know stuff that hadn't come out in the newspapers or hadn't been talked about. So, yeah.
Of course, I would have probably wanted to know too. I mean, people wanted to know about things like that. And it was, you know, and by him being, the thing that I find strange is that how celebrities and people that are really powerful public figures can have this dark, demonic side to them that they can hide behind PR people and, you know, different people that protect them and their images from the public. I mean, I wasn't a big O.J. Simpson fan. As a matter of fact, I ran into O.J. Simpson when I was quite young in modeling. At the time, I was being a house model for Vidal Sassoon in Beverly Hills, the first woman of color to do so. And we were invited to some party and he was there with another guy. I remember they walked through the room. It was maybe me and another little black girl. They looked at us like, yeah, right. And kept going into where they were going to. And that was my one encounter, you know, with him. And so he didn't strike me as someone that was very open or like one of those people that you meet, they're smiling. They're like, how you doing? He didn't do that at all. It was kind of like he had some purpose that he was there for that particular time.
When I found out that her ex-husband was indeed O.J. Simpson, it didn't matter to me because, as we talked about earlier, my celebrity restaurants were all A-list clientele. O.J. wasn't even really on my radar at the time. I knew who he was. I was perfectly familiar with his football career and his movies and acting and things like that. But he didn't matter that much to me. What mattered to me was Nicole. You know, I loved her. Until the stalking started and the events that he put us through, I really didn't think about him too much. But then obviously that led into the events that he put us through, which was horrible.
So I want to ask this in a certain way. How did it feel for you as a human being? You said it didn't bother you. But at night, when you're by yourself and you're alone and you're filtering through, you know, what am I doing in this situation? How did I get attached? I didn't know all of these things. Did he ever make you feel small? Like, oh, I'm O.J. Simpson and you're only a restaurant owner and you only get to entertain and to have celebrities dine. You're not a celebrity. Did he ever make you or anyone in his entourage make you feel that way? Did you feel small around them?
Well, that was entirely his mission, was to do that. And to go back just a bit, when I said he didn't really matter that much to me, that was initially. As the stalking began, and as Nicole started to tell me private things that had happened in the past and what OJ was capable of, then obviously the fear factor was raised. Nick looked me in the eye on several occasions and said, listen, Keith, there's two OJ Simpsons, the one everybody sees in public and the one that no one sees. And you don't ever want to be left alone with the one that no one sees because you don't know what he's capable of. Then, obviously, I started to worry. Did I think he was capable of what he did on June 12th of 94? Maybe not at that time, but looking back, the title of the book is called What It Is, because I honestly feel that at any moment during our relationship that it could have been me had the timing been a little different.
And that's the tagline, it could have been you. Because, I mean, did you feel at the time, what do I want to say? As you were trying to reclaim your life, did you feel uncomfortable that your name would be permanently tied to someone's tragedy? Because no matter what you do and where you go, someone's always going to be like, oh, wow, that's the same guy or that kind of thing. How did you go about reclaiming your own power back? How did you take it back so that you didn't feel threatened by him and he wasn't a big deal?
Well, I just continued on with my life. I'm a very public person. I had restaurants in New York City for the 20 years following the trial and the verdict, the misverdict, I should say, knowing that OJ was a free man and still talking about me in interviews and mentioning me in his book, If I Did It, on numerous occasions, very disparagingly. I didn't really try to hide from anything. I tried to use my shared experiences with Nicole to speak out for her because she couldn't. I tried to give her a voice from the grave about things that had happened so people understood more about what transpired in the couple of years leading up to the murders so they could understand what Nick went through and what OJ was capable of.
What did she go through? I mean, other than what we heard in the news, and I'm in the media, so what did she go through? I mean, I've been through a divorce and I understand the capability that men can have when they want control. When they want control of you, they don't want you to see other people. They want control for whatever reason that they do that. Did you have, were you the safe harbor that she had during the time she was going through this? She could call you up at 3 a.m. and say, baby, I'm scared. Or can you talk to me until the light leaves my front yard until I figure out what the dog is barking at? How, what did she go through?
Yeah, let's go through that timeline a little bit.
Yeah, let's go through
that. Met OJ when she was 18 years old. Oh, and it's very well documented that the first night she went out with him, she came home with her pants ripped. Her roommate, David LeBon, who was also a pallbearer at the funeral and very close friend, noticed that her pants were ripped after the first date. So if that tells you anything, and then she had 15, 16 years where she was under OJ's thumb. He controlled everything about her life, how she acted in public, what she wore, even to get breast augmentation that she initially did not want, that he basically made her get. So he controlled everything. I came along at a very unique time. Nick really only had about 18 months in her adult life where she had some freedom. From the time she left him in early 1992 until the time they tried the reconciliation in March, April of 93, that was the time when Nick was trying to experience some growth. Stuff that most people go through in their early 20s, you know, experiencing things, meeting new people, going on dates, having a relationship with someone like me. And even though our romantic relationship was really only about 2.5-3 months long, basically because of OJ's stalking, we realized it couldn't work. And I was heading back to Aspen for my work schedule. We became best friends. So for the next 15, 16 months, we talked every day about everything that was going on in her life, how she felt about things. And she told me, because we had that experience of the stalking, she opened up to me about stuff that had happened prior that I don't think she shared with anybody, including her family, beatings she had endured at his hands, mental abuse, physical abuse. So there was a lot of stuff that went on. I was so fortunate to have been a big part of Nick's life during that 18-month period that, I mean, I'm just glad to have been there for her and help any way I could.
And what a wonderful soul. Because most people most of the guys be like, look, I don't know this man, but I'm not in it. You know, you can deal with it by yourself. You're the one that, you know, dated him and all of that. But, you know, thank you for sharing that she was so young. Thank you for sharing that. Because at that age and with her being inexperienced, especially dating outside of her culture, I'm assuming that, you know, was something she had not done before. So it was somebody that was respected by the public and things like that. So you don't mind that they're whatever they culture they are, because they're someone well respected globally. So you're going to trust in that perhaps. But I'm glad that you said that she was under his thumb the entire time. I don't think maybe people out there don't understand what a narcissist can be like, or how people that are narcissistic into the capability that they will murder you or have you killed.
Well, remember, you know? Nicole, when they met and she was 18, she was roommates with David, the gentleman I just mentioned. They were best friends. She was trying to learn the LA lifestyle and be a part of that. And when OJ met her, he immediately put her up in an apartment. Now, OJ was married to Marguerite at the time.
I know.
So he immediately put her up in an apartment so he could keep an eye on her.
He'd have access to
tabs on her so he could control how she, you know, what she did and who she hung out with. So she wouldn't be in an apartment with this guy, David, who was actually just her best friend. So the control started instantly, you know.
That is so, I hate to hear that. Now, I want to know, what is it about her as a personality and her as an energy, her as a person that made you just feel so enraptured by her and her beauty? Because she was a very pretty girl. And then the second part of the question, when you finish answering that, is how did her family respond to you being there for her? What parts of her family were you drawn into because of your relationship with her?
Well, she was obviously strikingly beautiful. Anyone can see that. But there were so many other things about Nick, about her personality, just quirky. She was funny. She was tough. She stood her ground when she believed in something. Little things like she ate onions like apples. I had never seen that before, but it was just a weird little quirk. She popped her gum incessantly, you know. She was addicted to lip gloss. You know, there's a million little things. Incredible mother, funny, outgoing, so many great things about her. We don't have that much time, but her family, I got along fantastically with her family. She introduced me to her sisters first early on and then her parents, and we got along great. And when we decided to sort of slow down our romantic part and just sort of get into a great friendship, it was partially because one last stalking incident that OJ had put us through, where the family was exposed to that. We went down to Laguna to have a beach day. We took Sydney and Justin with plans of meeting all the sisters and their kids and Lou and Judy. And we were going to have a great day at the beach at Laguna. Well, shortly after we got there, someone tipped OJ off. He was out of town. Fortunately, he was in Houston. Someone tipped him off that we were down there. So the phone rings and he hears my voice and goes absolutely crazy. I put one of the sisters on the phone. He read her the riot act for 15 minutes on the phone. Then he called the family house and just laid into Judita and Lou about me being down there and me being around the kids and, you know, the whole craziness that I felt so horrible that things that had happened with Nick and I, the stalking incidents, had never involved her family prior to that. It had always been him following us. Now he brought the family into it. And I just felt horrible about all that. So at the end of that day, we walked down the beach in Laguna and we sat on one of the rocks and we looked at the sunset and just sort of talked about everything and agreed that it was going to be tough for us to have any kind of relationship based on what he had already put us through in the short 2 or 3 months we were together. And I was heading back to Aspen. So we said, listen, let's just back off a little bit, see where things take us. And that's when the best friendship I've had in my life started and continued until she passed away, until she was murdered.
Now, you say you were out of town. You were traveling at the time that she and Ron their lives were ended. What happened? Did you hear about it through the grapevine? Did somebody from the family call you? Did what happened? How did you find out initially?
I was in Atlanta looking for a restaurant. Okay. Not a lot of people knew where I was. And remember, this is pre-cell phone, really. Some people had big brick cell phones. I didn't. And a lot of people I knew didn't. So there wasn't that instant communication. A lot of people thought it was me. When the initial reports came out, Ron Goldman was identified as an unidentified male. I think his wallet got knocked out in the scuffle. And so for the first couple of hours, anybody who heard thought it was me, knew she was at Mezzaluna. Those reports had come out. Ron's name hadn't been mentioned. They knew of my history with her. So people initially thought it was me. I think her family actually thought that initially too, but they didn't know where I was at. So I was woken up in Atlanta by a friend's phone call that knew I had dated Nicole. And he said, Keith, turn on the news right away. And I turned it on and I was shocked. I immediately tried to call the Brown House. Line was busy, couldn't get through. Called my best friend, Ron Hardy, who was incredible friends with Nicole. She had introduced us. He confirmed, yeah, Keith, it's Nick. And it was a guy that worked for you as well. And finally, when I got through to the Browns, they asked if I could come out and be a part of the funeral and be a pallbearer. So I flew out the night before. The funeral was so quick. I flew out the night before and arrived in time to carry her casket and show her the honor that she deserved and have to stand next to the guy that I know murdered her. He was still a free man until the next day. The Bronco chase was the day after the funeral. So he was right there next to me, elbow to elbow almost at the
mano to mano.
Yeah, I mean, wow. At the burial, as we're laying her into the ground, I mean, it's him next to me. So imagine my feelings.
Did he seem to have any kind of remorse or feel sad? Or, I mean, I'm talking to you from a man to of seeing another man express emotion. Because I know my friends that have lost their girls or something, even in a breakup, not even, they're just like out, like, look, I can't talk, I can't eat, I can't, I don't know what to do. You know, what did you notice about his general being when you were there with him?
Well, I noticed when he got out of the limo, he had his dark glasses on, so you couldn't really make eye contact with him. But he did come over and embrace every pallbearer except me. So what does that tell you? Does that sound like an innocent man who's concerned about his wife being murdered and going to try to find out who did this? Or does that sound like a guy who is still angry at me because of the things that we went through?
Yeah.
And no one wanted to talk about it because that day was about Nicole.
Yes.
I mean, there were whispers. There were a few things I talk about in the book, how after the funeral, we stopped at Jack in the Box of all places to get some burgers before we got back to the Browns' house. So it was Chris and Bruce Jenner, Faye Resnick, myself, Ron Hardy, Robin Greer. Mm-hmm. And as we were sitting in Jack in the Box and just sort of having gone through the mass and the funeral, we started to discuss, hey, you know, you think he did it? Of course he did it. You know he did it. But that was the first time. Everybody wanted to show the respect for Nicole at the burial and the mass. So when we got back to her family's house later that day, the conversation started. But to answer your question, he didn't look remorseful. He looked almost angry. And I took that.
He couldn't use her anymore.
Well, I took that as he was angry that I was there. I mean, he hated me. You listen to that 911 tape in October of 93.
I was going to ask you, you're being psychic. I was going to ask you about the 911 tape because I was going to ask you, when you heard it then and your poor heart was breaking, who did you turn to for comfort and affection? And then also, when you, if you heard or if you have heard it again 30 something years later, did it have the same effect on you? Did you hear stuff that most of the public wouldn't hear because you actually knew her? What would tell us about that? I'd like to know more about your feeling.
Well, we have to put the 911 tape into context, first of all, so your viewers and listeners will understand how that all transpired. He was on the set of a movie. This was in October of 93. They had been trying their reconciliation for 3 or 4 months. So he hated me. Nick and I talked less and less. Our phone calls became less frequent because I couldn't call the house. If he was there and I called, he would go crazy. So it was always when we could get a hold of each other, which was sad because we went a year and a half talking every day. So he was on a movie set and there was a girl on the set of the movie who said something to him about my name and me dating Nicole in the past, and he went crazy. Before that happened, I came home in Aspen, Colorado. I wasn't in LA at the time. And I had a voicemail on my home answering machine. And it was OJ Simpson. Hey, Keith, it's your old pal OJ here. And then the girl who said something to him got on the phone and giggling like she was doing this on purpose. So I instantly thought of Nicole. I said, oh, this isn't going to be good for Nick. Tried to call her, couldn't get through to her. Tried to call her all night, couldn't get through to her. Next day, couldn't get through to her. Finally, after 3 days, she called me and said, I said, Nick, are you okay? And she said, no, Keith. And I said, I had a voicemail. She goes, I know. She said, it was horrible. She didn't say there was a 911 call. Remember, that wasn't released until the trial.
Yeah.
I didn't know. But she did say, Keith, he went crazy. We can't talk anymore. I'm really trying to give this reconciliation 100% of my effort. He tore up your phone, the phone book with your number in it. He ripped up all our pictures. He went crazy. He said, I can never speak to you again. And as we're having that conversation, my heart is breaking inside.
Yeah.
Last thing we said, I said, Nick, I'm so sorry. And she said, I am too. And I said, I love you. And I hung up the phone. And the next time I saw her, I was holding her casket at her funeral. So I never spoke to her the last 6 months of her life. But at the funeral, one of her sisters came up to me and said they were talking about me the night she was murdered.
Mm.
I hadn't spoke to her in 6 months, but at dinner at Mezzaluna, I don't know if it was Judita or one of the sisters said, well, what happened to Keith? And she said, you know what? I'm going to surprise him. And I never got that phone call. She was dead 2 hours later. So for me to be standing at the funeral next to the guy that killed her, holding her body in the casket and finding out from her family that she was thinking of me the night she was murdered, you try to grapple with that range of emotions.
I've been through major betrayals with people practicing witchcraft and all kind of weird stuff. So I can feel what I feel that. I mean, I'm a very, and you seem to be a man that can command his own emotions and can love and not be angry enough to, number one, especially being as mature as we are now, you can tell that it's something wrong with somebody if they're responding like that and they're a grown person. You're ripping people's pages out of a book. You're telling another adult that who they can talk to. That in itself, when you find out what narcissism is and people that are controlling like that, would lend to be a group of some behaviors that would be somebody that people would pay attention to. Like, I don't know if you should do. Why did she marry him? What happened? Did he hold something? Was she pregnant or anything was going on? Why did she get married?
She loved him. I mean, in the early days, she loved him. And he had that grip over her. She used to read a book when she was going through the divorce early on during our romantic period. She was seeing a psychologist or psychiatrist. I get them confused. I apologize. It was part of the divorce proceedings. But I remember we used to laugh. She brought a book home one day, and it was called, that the psychologist had given her, and it was called Women Who Love Men Who Hate Them. So she was like, look what the doctor gave me to read. And we were like, wow, you know. And it got to the stage where all she really wanted was the family, what mattered to her, because she did love OJ. I'm not going to take that away from him or her. They had a deep, passionate love for each other. Abusive, but I can't explain it.
But dysfunctional, but deep and passionate.
She tried one last time for that reconciliation, for the sake of that family unit, for the father of her children to be there. All she really wanted was that white picket fence, that whole thing that women grow up imagining the perfect life. And she gave it one last shot. He duped her. He told her he had been to therapy. He had changed. She was willing to give it one last shot for the sake of the children, and it cost her life.
Mm-hmm. And are we allowed to talk? Where are the children? What are all of them doing? Are they allowed to still be alive, speak, live normal lives? What's happening?
Well, they were... The Browns really had control of the children during the trial, obviously. Okay. They were the closest parental overseer. So after he was exonerated or found not guilty, then the civil trial happened, and then the custody trial, which was the last of the three. The Brown family contacted me in New York, where I was living at the time, and asked me if I would be willing to fly out and testify in the custody trial, knowing that it was them putting it on. It wasn't the state, you know, the expenses were going to be there. And I said, don't worry about me. I'll jump on a plane and I'll be there with bells on, because I want you to have those kids. I want to be like him. Yes. Well, I got out there to testify. The judge felt that my testimony wasn't necessary for whatever reason. After sitting there for 2 days waiting to testify, he got granted custody of the children, which was almost a foregone conclusion in the state of California, because he was not convicted of the crime. We were allowed one last night. I stayed during that period of time in the Brown household where Nick grew up, you know, the family house. They invited me to stay there during the trial. We got to take the kids out one last time for dinner, took them out for sushi all as a group. And then the next day they got handed over to him. I've never seen or spoken to them since that night we went out for sushi over 30 years ago. And that was... I believe he had a no contact order, is what I was told. Yeah. I wouldn't have reached out to them knowing that he had custody of them anyway. And they were very young when Nick and I were dating. They were young. I mean,
they're like 2 or 3 years old, right?
Justin was three and Sydney was five, you know, so
yeah, they were little kids.
Your memories of me are probably, you know, what you remember at 3 and 5 year old years old. So I remember teaching them how to ski, going with them skiing and riding bikes. And we used to take them to Magic Mountain for the roller coasters and to the beach. And we had a lot of good times together, but I never tried to step in to a role of, you know, being an absentee parent or, you know, something like that. That wasn't my place. And she understood that. So I never reached out. I never have to this day. From what I understand, Justin is living in Las Vegas. Sydney is living in Florida. Sydney's had a couple children. I think Justin has one too. I hear about them through the press, but I have no personal knowledge of what their lives are like.
Wow. So that, yeah. But you said you were best friends with her, and I'm sure that they probably would have known more about you had the circumstances been different and you were just dealing with a regular guy that wasn't angry and didn't want to, you know, kill or maim people because he didn't get his way or whatever. Now, let me ask you something. I'd always heard and been told in the streets here in L.A., that he had numerous affairs. And even though she was his main squeeze, I guess you say his wife, there was never really any kind of true commitment that he had to her, that he just wasn't right in the head. Is some of that true, all of that true, or?
All of that's true. He was a horrible womanizer. Nicole was well aware of that. She was deathly afraid of catching AIDS. Yes. Remember the time frame we're talking about, late 80s, early 90s, yeah. The whole Magic Johnson thing. She was, her biggest fear in life was to leave her children motherless. Yes. And turns out that's the way it ended up, but not for the reason she was thinking. She was fearful of that. She caught him. She knew about it. I write about it in the book, incidents where they would be out of town traveling on business and he would say he had a business meeting and he'd disappear for a couple hours, come back, you know, smelling of another woman. And she knew what was going on. She'd say something. He'd beat the hell out of her and lock her in a closet in the hotel.
What? You know,
yeah. Another form of control. And she told me about all this.
What did her, how, okay. Now, did she have any big brothers, cousins, members of the family that were gangsters that was not afraid of him to go after him doing all of that? I mean, if she showed signs of physically being abused, why wouldn't somebody tell the police or the FBI or somebody? I don't understand.
Well, I think she hid a portion of it out of fear for being judged. And some of the stuff came out in the press. Remember the New Year's Eve when the police showed up? And what did they do? They brushed it under the rug. He got no time. He got community service, and he didn't even fulfill his obligation in that. I don't think she was – well, I know that she wasn't proud of what she was enduring. I think she thought she could change him. I think she thought a lot of times over the years that she was enduring these beatings that hopefully it will change. Maybe if we have another child, it'll change. Sadly, it never did. And it escalated to a point that we all know what happened.
Oh, honey, I am so sorry, Keith, you had to go through all of that. And you know what the weird thing is now? Here she is with this weirdo. And here you are, this healthy, kind, loving, well, that's the way you appear to be. And I'm going to make that statement based on now having a conversation with you, that it seemed like she would have been brave enough with family support, with your support, to pull away and stay away. So do you think it's because he was a celebrity and all of that, that it some kind of psychological tie-in, like, well, he's a celebrity, and if I leave, it's going to be this, and it's going to be that, or I'll be blamed for this. What do you think held her there outside of, because after a while, the love leaves. Trust me when I tell you, I've had that experience. The love goes. There may be some emotional imprints, but that whole emotional thing, I know, you know, some of it became internal where you want to hurt yourself or whatever. But what do you think about that?
Well, I think he made it almost impossible for her. He fought her during the divorce on everything financially. There were times when he was going to report her to the IRS for
what?
To try to make her life as miserable as possible, to try to make her as financially dependent on him as he could, so he had a chance of getting her back. He always thought the end game was he was going to have her back. And I think that's why he was so angry, and he never got over me, because I was the guy that stood up to him. I was the guy who said no. You know, when he got in our faces, I said, I'm not going to leave you alone with her. I don't care who you are.
Good.
So.
Our hero, yes.
Stuck with him. There were other guys that Nick dated in that year and a half period. They were afraid to take her out.
I'm sure they were.
In public. I was the guy who said, I don't care about him. We're going to go to dinner. You're going to hang out.
I like you, yeah.
Yeah. So he never forgot that. He took that as a public shaming that I would be out somewhere with his wife.
Wife.
Soon to be
my wife.
His property. Let's put it that way, because that's what he can say. And he always thought, if I can make it difficult enough for her financially, because the kids were everything. All she wanted was the kids to be comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think he thought if he could make it tough enough financially, that she'd have no choice than to try to reconcile. Now, I don't know the reconciliation that they did try. We had long conversations about it when it first started. I expressed my opinion about it, but not maybe as vocally as I should have, because I wanted her to make her own decisions. But I told her, I said, Nick, are you sure about this? I said, I don't know, you know, so we talked about it. But in that case, he had convinced her he had changed and he was going to be a better man and a better father. All those things she dreamed about. And like I said, if they hadn't tried that reconciliation, I think she'd still be alive today.
Because she probably would have been.
Yeah, I think as time was passing, he was letting go a little more. But during the reconciliation, he got back. He grasped back on and couldn't let
go. Yeah, because he had to travel and be with other women and keep his other mistresses happy. But listen, what I wanted to ask as well, during the time that led up to her actual, what kind of relationship did you have with Ron? And then the second thing, how did he get involved? And then the second thing, how does Nelson Aspin, who did your foreword of your book, how is Nelson involved? How is he involved? I heard he was a witness. So answer both of those. Let me hear that.
Ron Goldman, I did not have the honor of meeting Ron Goldman. Oh. I had left Mezzaluna Restaurant Group and gone on to do my own thing. Ron was hired after I had left.
Oh,
I knew the entire staff at Brentwood. I had hired and trained all them, all the management. So I knew everybody there with the exception of Ron. I say in my book, I want to thank Ron. I think he tried to do something very noble and defend Nicole in a horrible situation. And he walked into a no-win situation, and he paid for it with his life. And I want to thank him for being that kind of man. And my heart breaks for him and his family every day. As far as Nelson Aspin goes, Nelson is my cousin.
And what?
Nelson Aspin is my cousin.
He's your real primal cousin.
Real primal cousin.
From your family.
We didn't meet until 1985, 86. When I had a restaurant in Beverly Hills before I moved to Aspen and started Mezzaluna, I had a different restaurant in Beverly Hills called Perrette's that I had opened on Olympic and Robertson. Nelson was a cousin who grew up in Pennsylvania. I grew up in Florida. I had heard about him. We had never met. So I get a call one day from my mother saying, your cousin Nelson's moving to L.A. to pursue his acting career. Could you give him a job or would you like to meet him? I said, absolutely. So we met, we hit it off. We became almost like brothers. He started working for me. I moved to Aspen, did the Mezzaluna thing. He stayed in LA. I eventually branched back out to California with the Mezzaluna restaurant group. And then I rehired Nelson. So Nelson worked for me in the Mezzalunas. He was there during the Nicole days. He actually would come over to Nick's house sometimes to the pool and hang out with us. He saw OJ come in the restaurant and confront me. So he was there for that. And to this day, Nelson and I are like this. I mean, that's why I asked him to write the foreword to the book. I thought, first of all, he's a brilliant writer in his own regard.
He is really good. I interviewed him. He's really good.
I thought to myself, who better than Nelson to write this, because he was there for it?
Small world. I had no idea. But you know what? As a matter of fact, Your face is a little bit heavier, maybe it's because of your beard or whatever, but you do have similar cheekbone structure right in there. You can see the, now, is it on your mom, dad's side? Is your first cousin, second cousin?
Second cousin, mother's side. My mom's father and his mom's father are brothers. So he's a second cousin, but we don't have a lot of first cousins in our family. So some of my cousins,
I thought the first cousins were.
Our grandfathers were related, not our parents.
Oh, okay. I got it. I was like, wait a minute. Okay. I got it.
But he knew all about me growing up and I knew about him growing up. You know, he was the actor in the family who went out to New York to make a name in acting. And I was the restaurateur in the family. And we just sort of hit together. I'm a few years older than Nelson. That explains the pudginess of the face.
No, he just looked like a version of him, but I didn't see that he had a beard. I met him and interviewed him on the show. He's very, very sweet and got his book and everything. And so I was wanting to know what the connection was, because it said that he was at, I'm like, well, how did he know everything? Now I understand. So let me back it up just a little bit. We've got a little bit, let's see how much time we have. I've got about maybe 5 minutes, I'll say. How has all of this affected your love life? Are you in love again? Do you want to be in love again? Did you find another beautiful woman to experience your beautiful person that you are? What happened?
Well, I never got married and I never had children, if that tells you anything. I had some great relationships over the years, but I could never really take it to that next level. I always found myself kind of pulling back a little bit if it got to that level. And I think I just always had a place in my heart for Nick. And I believe someday I'll see her again. As you know, I become a little more spiritual later in life. I'm happy about that. And at this stage now, maybe I'll find somebody, but I think that ship has sailed as far as getting married and making that kind of commitment. So I don't regret it. It's a little lonely sometimes not having that person to share your life with, like a lot of people do, but I've had incredible friends over the years that I cherish deeply. And I've always kept Nick right here. She's always been in my
heart. Yeah, that's why nobody can come in, because you've got Nick there.
You're right.
That's the reason. Yeah. It's hard. Yeah. And with her going the way she, you know, with the whole experience that you had, that's maybe difficult for you. I can see where that would, you know, it's like somebody that met their soulmate and nobody else is ever going to live up to the person. They're not going to fit. They're never going to be that person. So you either have to be on a different frequency, a higher frequency than the person, or, you know, not be the same. So you'd be taking less than what you've had and or getting more than what you have, but you'd have to go through the whole thing of opening your heart and all of that. Have you worked? Do you feel that your heart is closed? Do you feel like that's your choice?
I just think it's my choice at this point. I've had, like I said, so many great friends over the years that sort of fills that emptiness and that void. So the timing for Nick and I was obviously off. You talk about soulmates. If it had happened at another time in both of our lives, maybe circumstances would have been different. We hit that one spot and tragically events ended like they did.
And you were there at a time in her life where she really needed an honest person, loving, kind, caring person, not another a guy that just wanted to take advantage of her or manipulate her or whatever. So I really thank you, as I'm sure a lot of women out there, thank you. And I'm sure I'm going to be getting emails and stuff saying, where does he live? Is he single? He said he was single. we have to talk to his PR person about all of that. We don't want to rent him out or have him go shipped out there for no reason. Before we go, what is it that you want to say about how it was to be in love with someone like Nicole Simpson, in lieu that we have Valentine's Day in a few days? And in also what your social media tags, where we can find the book, where we can read the story. I'm sure it is very involved and we don't have enough time, but we talked about a lot in the time that we had. You talked about a lot of things. When you hear back, you'll hear how much information. But well, let's hear that.
I was fortunate to find Nicole and to meet her, and I don't regret any of that relationship. I obviously regret the way it ended and that I couldn't help in a deeper way, both by saving her physically and by testifying and maybe putting OJ away. But if you want to read about it and get the book, it's available on Amazon. It's called Stalked, It Could Have Been Me. You can type it in by the name and the tagline. My social media handles are my name, the spelling Keith Slomswich on both Instagram and Facebook. And I have a dedicated website for the book. I couldn't secure the title of the book. It was already taken. So I have ojstalkedme.com. So,
wow.
Yeah, I thought that was
ojstalkedme.com. Well, he's dead now himself, isn't he?
That's why I wrote the book now. And that's one question I expected from you. Why did you wait 32 years? Quite honestly, I waited until he died to do it. So
wow, that is it. Because now it all come together. I'm like, oh, now I see why you waited 30 years. You would have taken a risk for your life, possibly.
100%.
Way big. And then the other thing is that did he leave anybody behind that you feel threatened by or anything like that? You don't. You know, and I'm glad you don't have somebody to be under all of that kind of pressure, you know.
I'm not worried. I didn't live my life worried for those 30 years when he was on the planet. Certainly, I felt a little safer during the time he spent in prison in Las Vegas, you know, and there were a lot of nights walking home in New York City from my bar up there and those dark side streets with the stoops, you know, and the stairwells, you know, New York City. I'm sure you've been there before. It gets a little scary at 4 o'clock in the morning walking home. So thought crossed my mind, am I completely safe all the time? But I didn't hide from anything. I live my life in public and I'll continue to do that.
Well, you are a treasure. I'm sure the kind of man that any of us women with open hearts and loving kind souls would treasure. So, you know, don't keep yourself so closed off. You never know. Things happen at very strange things happen in life. It very depends on the timing, I will say. And then we want to welcome you again. Thank you so much for coming onto our show. I really appreciate your candor. I appreciate you being honest and open about someone you loved and cared about and what happened. And I certainly appreciate that you were brave enough to write about it and to tell us the story. Because I always wanted to know the inside. Like I said, I was around a lot of people like OJ, Muhammad, and those guys, but I didn't live a fast life. I've always been a Buddhist and lived a spiritual kind of life. So I'm, you know, my energy would go towards other things, although I did hang out and get to go to a lot of things, you know, things like that. But it was really, really just interesting to have you on the show and to get a fresh perspective about something that happened very long ago, but people out there are still wondering what happened. And especially because it was O.J. Simpson, and in the Black community, O.J. Simpson was like, oh my God, he's a big deal. He's a star. He's a king, you know, things like that. And then to have something like that tarnish his name and the name of people that were associated with him. So I appreciate you coming on to the show. Before we go, I want to say thanks to Sam Hassan, the owner and person that runs LA Talk Radio. Thank you for helping to bring my shine to the forefront every week. I want to say shout out to the luminaries out there. I loke you. People, you're a luminary. There are people that are light. They're conscious and aware of things. And they watch and care about how they treat other people and thus how they are treated in return. And so I want to tell you, I loke you. I love you for being who you are, for being brave, coming out in the world like this gentleman does and still living a life, even though things might be happening around your circumstances. Don't forget to always believe in yourself, if no one else. And I loke you, I like you for putting up with me every week, coming in to listen to me and hear what I got to say. I will tell you that I'm in there with you. None of us have easy lives, although money can help cushion some of those times and troubles, but it does not prevent us from going through what we need to go through to learn our lessons in life. So I want to thank you for being here with me. Don't forget to like and subscribe. I cannot do it without you. We need the numbers. and I need you to listen, and I need to talk to you and see your face. That's why I come on here to see you and talk to you, make sure all of you are okay out there. It's a lot going on. If you want to look me up, I'm under Instagram, Osiris_Munir_the painter. I am an abstract painter, and I do look for certain palettes in my mind to bring out and express to you. And again, let's thank our guest and our author and writer and brave, dear soul, Mr. Keith Slumsowich. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you. Next week, we're going to have another guest. And for now, go get his book, Stalked. It Could Have Been Me. I get why you said it could have been me. Just now it came to me. Because you could have been with her instead of Ron. You could have been hanging with her instead of Ron. But it was Ron that, you know, was with her the night that they caught them off guard. It could have been you. I totally get it now. Bless your heart. My heart goes out to your dear heart. All right, everybody. We'll see you next week. And bye.
You're listening to The Osiris Munir Show. Only on LA Talk Radio.